David mentioned, has been a long-held dream of mine to actually travel along Rome's eastern frontier. This began really with my work in Jordan, which I've been doing here since 75. And as Dave mentioned, I did a survey of the frontier in 1976. But if you look at a map of the eastern frontier of the empire, which extended from the Black Sea down to the Red Sea, this entire enormous area, you see that the frontier sector, which is in Jordan, is indeed a small part of the total eastern frontier of the Roman Empire. But in Jordan, since 75, I had the opportunity to dig at a couple of important frontier sites, especially Umm al-Jamal in 1977, where we returned to work under the direction of Bert de Vries in 81. And then my own project that David earlier pointed out, the El Lejun excavation, also called the Central Limes Arabicus Project, in which we're concerned with a very limited, about 100 kilometer sector of the eastern frontier here in Jordan. That is primarily the sector east of the Dead Sea in this area. Anyway, as I found myself sort of honing in on the area around El Lejun and the eastern frontier, I began to realize that I was looking at a narrower and narrower focus. And this really aroused the need to broaden the scope of my research and to see the larger picture, as we call it. So thus I began a study of the entire eastern frontier of the Roman Empire. And so now I'm pursuing what we might call two parallel and yet two distinct lines of research. On the one hand, I'm interested in this very, very narrow area of the frontier around El Lejun, south of Amman, east of the Dead Sea, which is a study of the eastern frontier at the tactical level. And secondly, the project that I'm speaking of tonight, which is an attempt to research the entire eastern frontier from the Black Sea to the Red Sea, that is a study at the strategic level. I began this latter project where all such research should begin at a good library, in this case the Dumbarton Oaks Center for Byzantine Studies in Washington, D.C., where I was a fellow in 79-80. And there I first of all set the parameters for this work. First of all, the geographic parameters, and as I mentioned, the geographic parameters are more than 3,000 kilometers from the Black Sea to the Red Sea. Secondly, the chronological parameters, and I decided to concentrate on the period of direct Roman rule in this area. From the first century BC, when the Roman general Pompey conquered this area called the Levant and added it to the Roman Empire, until the early 7th century AD, the time of the Islamic invasions, for our purposes up to the Battle of the Yarmouk, fought, of course, near here in 636 AD. So because this is an enormous area that is 3,000 kilometers and an enormous time frame, 7 centuries, some sort of sharpened focus for this large topic needed. And thus, I decided to attempt not a history of the entire frontier, which probably would be a work of a lifetime, but rather a study of the evolution of frontier policy pursued by the Roman Empire, i.e., what actual strategies were employed by the empire to guard its most populous and wealthiest provinces here in the Eastern Empire. Once the outlines of this project were established, I then attempted an overview of the primary sources while at Dumbarton Oaks, and to briefly go over what the sources are for this study, the literary sources, there are an enormous number of ancient writers, of course, for this period of 700 years, a wealth of inscriptions and other kinds of written evidence, and also archaeological evidence, although covering the archaeological evidence was a less imposing task, simply because apart from a few spectacular sites, such as Dura Europus, here on the Middle Euphrates, a very little excavation has been conducted along in the military sites of the eastern frontier. You know, a good example of the paucity of archaeological research until very recently is here in Jordan, where until we did a sounding of the Roman barracks at Umm al-Jamal in 1977, not a single Roman military site had ever been excavated in this country. And so for the most part, not only in Jordan, but for Syria and eastern Turkey, I have to rely on surveys of varying usefulness and reliability some done almost a century ago. One example here is a map of the Syrian frontier, although I know it's difficult to see, it's just a Xerox. This is based on an aerial survey by Poidebar during the French Mandate period in the 1920s and 30s. He pointed out numerous sites and roads and so forth, which you can see on the map here. But of course, the problem with his survey is dating these sites. They could date to any time during the seven centuries that I've outlined, plus the pre-classical or the Islamic periods. Anyway, the next logical step was to see for myself as much of the eastern frontier as possible. And this is what I'm talking to you about tonight. Not in any sense a formal archaeological survey, one person, one vehicle, one month. It was hard to even envision that. But simply to gain a first-hand familiarity with the environment, the terrain, the major and minor sites along the bulk of the frontier unknown to me, i.e. that in Syria and eastern Turkey. And thanks to a six-month postdoctoral fellowship through ACOR, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, this dream became a reality in October of this year. So tonight, I would like to share two things with you. First of all, an overview of my trek along the eastern frontier to enable you to grasp something of the tremendous diversity of environments and peoples faced by the Romans. And secondly, a brief sketch of the major phases of frontier policy pursued by Rome during its 7th century domination of the Levant, its objectives, implementation, and the relative success or failure of these policies. Finally, let me apologize for the lack of many slides tonight. I took hundreds of slides while I was on the trip, none of which have been developed yet. But I will try to illustrate the general principles of policy with the maps that you see here and a few slides of the frontier in this area in Jordan. First, to begin with a topographical summary and an outline of my trip itself. We're talking really in the eastern frontier about three major environmental zones. The Syrian desert, of course familiar to all of us, extending from southern Jordan up to the Euphrates, this area here known as the Syrian desert. This is a semi-arid desert fringe at ordinarily receiving 150 to 200 millimeters of annual rainfall. And this line, the 200 millimeter annual rainfall line, formed the Roman frontier at the edge of the cultivated zone. In this southeastern sector of the frontier, the Romans had two primary concerns. First of all, to control the incursions of nomadic Arab tribes who were trying to push into the empire out of Arabia and out of the Syrian desert. And secondly, to control Palestine to the west of the frontier, which was the key land bridge between the two most important provinces of the Roman East, Syria and Egypt. The second of these environmental zones is the Mesopotamian plain itself, this area here between the Tigris and the Euphrates. This was a rich alluvial plain with wet, mild winters and torrid, dry summers. The major threat here was the Iranian Empire. First, the Parthians, who came from the area south of the Caspian Sea, controlled most of Mesopotamia and were the only major civilized state on the borders of the empire, anywhere, in fact. And after the fall of the Parthians, the Sassanid Persians, from the 3rd century AD on, who came from Persis, that is, south Iran, and also controlled the same area. And as we'll see, they were a much more formidable threat to Rome than the Parthians had been. They were capable of major offenses against the Roman Empire. The third area, the last area, is the north, what we will call the Cappadocian frontier tonight. The south part of the Cappadocian frontier is formed by the river Euphrates, the upper Euphrates in this area here. Very deep gorges in this area. And the north part is a land frontier extending from the source of the Euphrates near Erzurum, which was the furthest east I got, up to Trabzon, which was the north point of my survey on the Black Sea itself. This is wild, rugged country with high mountains, deep river gorges, and heavy forests, much more precipitation than areas to the south, especially fierce cold winters with heavy snowfall. There were two major threats in this area also. The forces of either of the Iranian empires could try to invade the empire via Armenia, this area here. And there was also the threat of the Caucasus tribes in the north and today in the southern Soviet Union, such as the Alani and the Iberians, who could try to penetrate from the northeast and thus into Anatolia and the empire. Now to turn to the actual route that I followed in October. Beginning from Amman, I drove up to Damascus, and after visiting the Department of Antiquities there, I then spent some time in the southern part of Syria in what is known as the Haran or the Jebel Druze. This area was part of the old province of Arabia. Most important was the capital of the old Arabian province, Bosra, ancient Bosra, right here in extreme southern Syria. The Roman province of Arabia consisted of this south edge of Syria, modern-day Transjordan, the Negev, and the Sinai were all part of the Roman province of Arabia. I also visited Shapa, which is ancient Philippopolis. That's where the one Arab emperor came from, whoever ruled the Roman Empire, Philip the Arab, who reigned in the mid-3rd century AD. The Haran is characterized by rich volcanic soils, is well-watered in the winter, and thus it was very thickly settled in antiquity. For example, Howard Butler, of a early Princeton archaeological expedition in around 1905, noted 70 towns and villages in this area. And those of you who have seen Umm al-Jamal within Jordan, but in the southern edge of the Haran, have seen a very typical town of the Haran. From Damascus, I then drove via Palmyra to Deir ez-Zor on the Euphrates across central Syria. This was the line of the so-called Strata Diocletiana, that is Diocletian's Road, built about AD 300, just east of the cultivated area as the outer edge of a fortified zone. This is a blow-up map here. This is Damascus here, Palmyra, and Deir ez-Zor, and the road basically followed a northeasterly direction along the edge of a mountain chain, just on the east side of a mountain chain called the Jebel Rawak. This was a great natural barrier with about 12 forts placed to control key passes through the mountain range, and I visited most of these dozen or so small forts, apparently of contemporary date, to guard this sector of the frontier. The key site, of course, is Palmyra itself, ancient Tadmor in the pre-classical period. This was the major oasis between the Syrian coast and the Euphrates. I know some of you have seen it. It was the base of the first Illyrian legion under Diocletian. From Deir ez-Zor, I went down the Euphrates to visit Dura Europus, and this certainly was one of the most exciting sites that I saw in my trip. Dura is a fortress city on the bank of the Euphrates, occupied successively by the Seleucids, the Parthians, and the Romans. It's a city in many ways frozen in time, because in AD 260, the Parthians sacked the city. They wiped out its Roman garrison, and the site was never again reoccupied. And because of the dryness of the climate, we have tremendous preservation at this site. No single site in the entire Roman Empire has ever produced more evidence about the Roman army than Dura Europus. Just a few examples. Soldiers in complete sets of armor have been found trapped in siege tunnels under the walls, which collapsed and buried them alive. We have the complete archive of a Roman military unit on papyrus, which lists all the soldiers in the unit, their rank, how much they were paid, where they were on duty at the time the garrison fell, and so forth. The earliest Christian church in the world from the early 3rd century has been founded Dura Europus, etc., etc. So a very important site. The Persian and Roman siege works survive as well. So you can see what measures the Persians took to undermine the wall, to force the wall, the countermeasures that the Romans took as well. Only had a day at Dura, I could have spent a week there.
Is it Mari, the same place?
It's, yes, it's very near Mari. Dura is just upstream from Mari. Mari's not more than 30 kilometers, almost at the Iraqi border. Mari, of course, a famous Bronze Age site of Mesopotamian civilization. Anyway, from Deir ez-Zor, which was our base for several days, I then drove up the Khabur River, which is a major tributary of the Euphrates, flowing from north to south. This was the Roman border in Mesopotamia for over 400 years. That is, Rome controlled the area to the west, and Parthia, and then later the Sassanid Persians, the area to the east. I visited a number of tells, all unexcavated, on the west bank, which supposedly are, or they're called Roman frontier posts. But the lack of visible ruins on the tops of these tells, the lack of any excavation, or even surface sherding of these sites, makes it very difficult to know which were actually Roman. From Deir ez-Zor, finally leaving Deir ez-Zor, drove up the Euphrates, visiting sites such as Raqqa and Sura and Rusafa, ancient Sergiopolis, and then on to Aleppo, completing the Syrian part of my trip. I should mention here Sergiopolis, Rusafa, about 50 kilometers south of the Euphrates, a fortified city and Christian pilgrimage center in the 4th through the 7th century, for Arab tribes who were allied to the empire, especially the so-called Ghassanids, who we'll be talking about more later tonight. And also, I should mention Dipsi Farage. Right at this bend where the Euphrates turns from a south flow to an east flow, this is one of the few forts excavated, done recently in the 1970s by a team from Dumbarton Oaks as a salvage operation because of the construction of the Tabqa Dam, which is now formed Lake Assad in northern Syria. Dipsi Farage, you can just see the tops of the walls now. The rest of the site is underwater. From Aleppo, I crossed into Turkey, first into Antioch, which was the third city of the Roman Empire, as many of you know, after Rome itself and Alexandria. It had probably a well-earned reputation as one of the flesh pots of the empire. And then through the Cilician gates and across the Euphrates, crossing east of the Euphrates for the first time into Urfa, ancient Edessa. This was the capital of a state called Osroene in this area here, which until about 200 AD was an important client kingdom of the Romans, and more about client kingdoms in a moment, until it was annexed as part of the province of Roman Mesopotamia in 200. This, though, even after the annexation, remained a major city of Mesopotamia and a key center of Syriac Christianity, with what has been called an early, quote, university, unquote. There's some argument about that among scholars. From Edessa, Urfa, I was able to visit Haran, ancient Kar Hai, where one of the famous battles of antiquity was fought. The Romans got their pants kicked in that one. And up to Samosata, which was a key crossing point of the Euphrates. When I got to the Euphrates, I had been told in Urfa by the police, where I had to check in each city that I visited in Turkey at the police departments. And I was told that there was a bridge which would get me to the other side at Samosata. And so we drove, myself and two Turkish policemen, we drove to the river, and there was no bridge. And so one of the policemen I was with scouted around the neighborhood, and he came back to me and said, "There's no bridge, but there is a ship. There is a ship." So I said, "Okay." So we drove down to the riverbank, and there was a ship. It was a boat about a third the size of this room, made out of wood, planks with asphalt between the planks. And they wanted me to put the Acor Land Rover on this little boat. And then there was a little rowboat with an outboard motor which towed this other little boat over the Euphrates.
And we were outraged that he, in fact,
didn't. So, you know, it took a long time for me to be convinced of this, because I could just imagine coming back to Acor at the end of my trip and telling David that the Land Cruiser was, well, I was at the bottom of the Euphrates. But the policeman said, I guarantee that nothing will happen. Well, you know what that was worth in case I had lost the Land Rover. Well, I did see another car cross on this thing, and so I decided to take the chance, and I did take the cruiser both ways on the Euphrates on this ship. Okay, anyway, from Urfa, I then traveled up to Malatya, here on the map, which was, it's about 50 kilometers west of the Euphrates, and was ancient Melitene. I was now in Cappadocia, and this was now very rugged travel through the Kurdish Taurus Mountains. At Old Malatya, there are the remains of a legionary fortress, the 12th Fulminata Legion, which were very impressive. From Malatya, I crossed the Euphrates into Armenia and reached Erzurum, which I earlier mentioned, ancient Theodosiopolis in extreme northeastern Turkey. And wanted to see the city fortifications there. It was a major center in the Byzantine period. It was the key fortress of Byzantine Armenia near the source of the Euphrates. This is also a sensitive military area, as you can see near the Soviet border. The police not only accompanied me here, but they actually wrote down the subject of every photograph that I took. And for example, I wanted to take a photograph of snow on the mountains, nice tourist type shot. But there was a radio tower on the mountain, so I couldn't take a picture of the mountains and so forth. Anyway, from Erzurum was my last leg north, first to Sitala, which is another legionary fortress in a mountain valley. This was the base of the 15th Apollinaris Legion at over 3,000 meters elevation. It was freezing there in October when I was there. And I tried to imagine what spending a winter in the Sitala would be like. And finally, Trabzon, ancient Trapezus on the north shore, or on the south shore of the Black Sea. This was a Greek colony in origin from the 6th century BC, but it became the extreme northeastern outpost of the Roman Empire, a legionary base, and the headquarters of the Pontic Fleet, which patrolled the Black Sea and kept it safe for commerce in the Roman period. Spent several days in Trabzon enjoying the ocean and the Black Sea fish, and then the long trek back to Amman. Altogether, it took 6,500 kilometers to do this trip, and it really reinforced in my mind the tremendous diversity of topography and climate and peoples that faced the Romans in the formulation of their eastern frontier policy over seven centuries. So that's the itinerary of my trip. And now I'd like to talk about what I learned from this. That is, my current reconstruction of an outline, you might call it, of Roman frontier policy from 64 BC to AD 636. We should begin then when Rome first conquered the area, when the Roman general Pompey came down from Anatolia and entered Syria in the 60s BC. Rome, in fact, had conquered the entire eastern Mediterranean in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, and it culminated in Pompey's annexation of Syria as a Roman province and the reduction of all the other Levant states to tributary status. Expansion further east, though, beyond the line of the Euphrates River, proved much more difficult. Parthia, which, as I mentioned, was the only major civilized state left in this part of the world, just beyond the river, proved much more difficult to conquer than earlier states. In fact, two Roman invasions of Parthia proved to be disasters. As I mentioned, in 53 BC, Crassus, a Roman general, at Kar Hai, right near the Turkish-Syrian border, was wiped out with 50,000 troops lost on the Mesopotamian plain. And in 36 BC, Mark Antony tried to invade Parthia through a more northerly route through Armenia. And this wound up with him in retreat and having lost the bulk of his army. So two lessons apparently were enough for the Romans. The legions which they had conquered the Mediterranean world with were not suitable for the plains of Mesopotamia, and the first Roman emperor, Octavian Augustus, realized that Parthia could not be conquered. But he also realized that Parthia was not capable of major offensive operations against the eastern provinces of the empire. So therefore, he basically reaffirmed a frontier policy first established by Pompey before these disastrous Parthian campaigns, which I'd now like to outline. The first element of this policy was peace with Parthia, with the Euphrates as the frontier between the two empires. Syria, and by Roman Syria, we mean a smaller area than modern Syria on the map, but from the Euphrates to the Black Sea and down to about the Damascus area. This was garrisoned with a strong force of four legions to oppose any Parthian advance over the river. Armenia to the north, this area served as a buffer state between the two areas controlled by neither empire. And the rest of the Roman East was ruled through a system of what was called client rulers. Now, what do we mean by client rulers? Well, such people as King Herod of Palestine or the Nabataeans here in Transjordan. These were usually native dynasties ruling small states. They were expected to show complete loyalty to Rome and ruled at Rome's pleasure, that is, they could be removed at any time. They were expected to maintain internal security in their own kingdoms and provide troops for external Roman campaigns. They were also expected to urbanize their state. Herod would be a good example of this with his foundations at Samaria and Caesarea and so forth. And they were also expected to also Romanize their upper classes. Most client states then were ultimately annexed as provinces into the Roman Empire. But for 150 years, the Romans did not simply redeploy their army. The four legions remained here in Syria and clients to the north and south. Therefore, the Romans were able to rule large areas indirectly without the considerable costs and finances and manpower of direct provincial administration. This policy, established by Pompey and also reaffirmed by Octavian Augustus, proved effective for a long period from 64 BC to AD 69, or about 150 years. There is a major change, though, that occurs in what we call the Flavian era, which begins about 70 AD. Flavian policy can also be characterized as primarily defensive against the Parthian threat, but still is considered a marked or a major change in policy, because the Flavians annexed most of the client states that were left in the east, and they redeployed the legions in what we might call a single line or a so-called linear defense from Cappadocia to Jordan. So remember, in the first phase, there were just the four legions here in Syria, client states to the north and south without Roman troops. Now the Flavians annexed most of these client states, and they also redeploy the army so that there are now legions at set points roughly equidistant from each other all the way down to the Red Sea. There were two legions now in Cappadocia, three still in Syria, two in Palestine, and one in Bosra, just across the border here in Jordan. If we could have the first slide now, I think we can see this policy in action here in Jordan. Okay. This is a picture of the Roman frontier in Jordan during the 2nd century AD. It's called the Antonine Limes because most of the emperors in this period were of that dynasty, the Antonine dynasty. We'll be showing you the northern sector of the frontier here in Transjordan, first the Roman province of Arabia, and then we'll be showing you the southern sector on the next slide. Forts are indicated by these squares, and the watchtowers are indicated by these little X's that you see here. It was one Roman legion in Bosra, I mentioned earlier, just across the border here, which was the base of this area's only legion, the 3rd Cyrenaica Legion. And then there were other forts that basically follow the line of the Via Nova Traiana, that is a major north-south highway, which you can still see in parts of Jordan. Today it's called the King's Highway, but it's basically this north-south line. Here is the southern sector of the frontier, and note, almost all the forts along the frontier basically are built directly on or near this Via Nova Traiana. So this is an example of the linear defense, which was employed by the Romans to defend the entire eastern frontier beginning around 70 AD and continuing for the next 150 or so years. Okay. Now we have to ask, why this change in policy? It appears that all over the empire in this era, that is the late 1st and 2nd centuries AD, there was a shift to, quote, scientific frontiers, unquote. This is the concept of a limes, L-I-M-E-S, based on a continuous chain of forts linked by roads, which formed a preclusive defense. The idea is to defend all of the frontiers of the empire directly with imperial forces, no longer using client states for the most part, to enhance the security of the entire empire. And in fact, there probably was a higher level of security with this kind of defense. In fact, Jordan enters one of its most prosperous periods in this time. It is true that the client rulers were less expensive, but they could not provide as high a level of security as the regular imperial forces. Also, the quality of client leadership varied greatly. Sometimes you got quite excellent so-called clients, as for example Herod of the Jews. Other times you did not get such high... So now there were a total of 10 legions along the eastern frontier. Don't forget, under Pompey and Augustus, there had been only 4. What really changes the picture here is the so-called crisis of the 3rd century, in the middle part of the 3rd century, for about 50 years. In this period, the entire empire was racked by severe problems, and the East, of course, did not escape these. There was a continuing series of civil wars, external invasions, depopulation, rampant inflation, and economic collapse in the empire. In the east, in this area, a new factor was introduced by the overthrow of the Parthian dynasty in Iran and substitution by a new Iranian power, the Sassanid Persians. They were a much more formidable threat to Rome than the Parthians had been. The Sassanids had a more centralized state. They had a national church based on Zoroastrianism and a permanent standing army with siege capability, something that the Parthians had lacked. The evidence for their siege capability is, of course, Dura Europus. Despite its massive fortifications, they seized this place by storm and through siege warfare almost as soon as they seized power in Iran. The Persians, after this, repeatedly invaded and ravaged the eastern provinces. Also, there is the brief and meteoric rise of the client state of Palmyra, which we've already mentioned here in north-central Syria, which made a brief bid for supremacy in the Near East, but was destroyed in 273 AD by the Romans. The crisis the empire faced was finally ended by the Emperor Diocletian, who was forced to develop new policies, including frontier policies, to deal with these problems. The next two centuries of Eastern Frontier, therefore, from about 284 to 527 AD, we can talk about Diocletian and defense in depth. First of all, the size of the army was increased greatly. Secondly, the army was divided into two kinds of forces for the first time. In Latin, the so-called comitatensis, which were a mobile field army kept behind the frontiers, and the limitanei, That is frontier forces who were to hold the actual line of fortified strong points. These two sides were to work in cooperation, of course. There was a massive program of military works. Roads were rebuilt, and forts were in some cases newly erected or they were repaired, and cities were also refortified in this period. His basic then approach was to create military zones on the edge of all the frontiers, 20 to 70 kilometers in depth, with the frontier forces holding fixed points and denying food and supplies to any invaders, until the mobile strike forces could be assembled to repel the attack of the invaders. The best evidence for this new approach on the eastern frontier is the central Arabian frontier, which I'll show you some slides of now, and also the so-called Strata Diocletiana, which I pointed out to you earlier here in central Syria. So again, if we can have the projector. And we'll move ahead now to the Arabian frontier under Diocletian. Just to show you the difference, let me go back to the Antonine period in the north. Look especially in this area here, where we east of the Dead Sea, where we have these two forts that control the crossing of the Wadi Mujib, and just a screen of these little watchtowers to the east. Under Diocletian, we now have a whole new a series of forts east of the main highway, Kastil, Zona, Thuria, Bashir, the site that we're excavating now, El Lejum, the legionary fortress in this area, and other sites here as well, all of which were built in a very short time, around 300 AD, to create a zone, a fortified zone or a limes in this area about 20 to 30 kilometers in depth. What kinds of sites were these? This is the southern part of the frontier in Jordan. We have new forts at El Mutrab, El Hammam. You'll also notice east of the Via Nova, Karana, east of the Via Nova. And this new fortress, which I'm still arguing is 3rd century or early 4th century, despite the excavations that are going on now by Alistair Killick, who had put it about 200 years earlier. We're getting only part of the slide here for some reason. Is it going in all the way there?
Yeah. Reverse it one. Now thanks.
This is an aerial photo of El Lejum, which we're getting cut off here at the sides for some reason. But anyway, large fortress about 11 acres in area. We're excavating now. It's the base of the 4th Mars Legion, east of the Dead Sea, built by Diocletian, probably. Here's an architectural plan of the fortress based on an early German plan drawn in the early 20th century. The basic features are outset projecting towers, which are characteristic of late Roman fortifications in this period, to permit enfilading fire from the flanks for somebody trying to go over the walls of the fortress. 4 gates, each of them flanked by 2 of these projecting interval towers. The whole eastern half of the fortress is devoted to 6 major blocks of barracks where the rank and file troops lived, and the headquarters building, the so-called Principia, here in the central portion of the site. Probably garrisoned by a much smaller legion than the earlier empire. In the early empire, we know that legions were about 5,000 men. But this fortress is only 20% the size of a fortress of the early empire. My estimate is about 1,500 men for this legion of later empire. Here's an architectural reconstruction, partly guesswork, of course, as to what the legionary fortress actually looked like under Diocletian, the projecting towers that you see here and so forth. Maybe we can... There we go. There we go. Thank you. And of course, the roads which lead into these 4 gates, the barracks blocks, you can see here. The headquarters building is the larger building here. And you can see how any attacker trying to break into the gates or over the wall here would face fire from 3 different directions. So these are fortified strong points held by the so-called Lima Tanai, Tanahi, that is the frontier forces. Now, there were smaller posts as well. Qasr Bashir, which we did soundings at this summer, also built in the Diocletianic era, as proved by the Latin building inscription over the main gate here. Scott Ralston there, by the way, under the gate. This is another fortified strong point, as you can see by its plan. This is the plan of Qasr Bashir. There's only a single gate, and the single gate is flanked by these projecting rectangular towers. Central courtyard with the barracks built up against the wall so that enemy missile fire could go over the wall but would simply fall in this courtyard area. And then four huge rectangular towers at each corner. These are of three stories where the defense would be concentrated. These are small posts. This is only about 55 meters square, but they could be held by small garrisons, perhaps 100 or 200 men, and they would have been very difficult nuts to crack, especially by the Saracen Arab nomads in this area, of course, who would have lacked siege equipment. Here's a plan of the barracks at Ugul Jamal, up in the north, which we did soundings in 1977, and we established an early Byzantine date around 400 AD, so soon after Diocletian. This fort lacks the projecting towers that you see here, and also, of course, reflects Christian influence with this later chapel that's been added to the eastern wall of the fort. We think that this fort may have been later converted into a monastery in the 6th or 7th centuries AD. There was a backup, also frontier, a secondary frontier, if the Saracen tribes in this area were able to penetrate the frontier here in Transjordan. This is the limes of southern Palestine and how it looked in the 4th century immediately following Diocletian's reign. It was a chain of forts which extended from near Gaza in the south part of Palestine across to near the south end of the Dead Sea. And you can see there are these major forts which are the double enclosed squares here, and smaller forts are these smaller X's, or smaller squares here. There was a concentration of cavalry units here, which formed a secondary backup to the Arabian limes here, and also guarded southern Palestine from nomadic incursions from the Sinai and from the Negev as well. I think that's all for this set here. Yeah, okay. So, defense in depth. This worked out very well for the Romans. It provided good security for the Eastern Empire, but at great cost, because the army had to be increased to hold all these numerous posts, and so taxes had to be increased with those kinds of consequences. Now, the last phase of the policy along the frontier was that employed in the 6th and early 7th century, and the architect here is primarily the Roman Emperor or early Byzantine Emperor Justinian. He, for reasons that we'll discuss below, tried to revert to the client state strategy, which you recall had been used at the very beginning of the Roman occupation of the Near East. Why? Because he had very ambitious goals elsewhere in the empire and merely sought peace on the eastern frontier. He was faced with serious invasions on the Danube in southeastern Europe, and he also tried to reconquer the lost Western Empire, which had collapsed under the onslaughts of German barbarians in the 5th century AD. So he launched very extensive campaigns in Western North Africa and in Italy and Spain, for example. He also engaged in a massive program of public works, civil, military, and cultic religious. For example, Hagia Sophia, the famous church in Constantinople, Istanbul, is of his period. So his policy in the East was simply to keep the peace with the Sassanid Persians. And to that end, he did maintain a strong defense in the northern half of the frontier. That is in this Mesopotamian zone that we've talked about and the Cappadocian zone to the north. Here he maintained strong defenses and strong garrisons. But he disbanded most of the frontier forces in the southern part of the frontier, that is the Syria and Transjordanian sector, and turned over primary defensive responsibility increasingly to Arab federates, that is federated tribes who served under their own sheikhs or phylarchs for pay from the Byzantine treasury. The Ghassanids, the family of Ghassan, was elevated to super phylarch status to oversee security for the entire Syrian desert frontier from this bend in the Euphrates here down to Aqaba on the Red Sea. Most forts of Limes were abandoned and their garrisons demobilized. And again, the maps will tell the tale for the Arabian sector of the frontier here in Jordan. Look at the map now. Almost all the forts in the north have been abandoned. There are about six left. Note that in the area east of the Dead Sea, where we had this strong screen of forts here under Diocletian, 4th and 5th centuries, now only three forts show evidence of occupation. In the south, the picture is even more glaring. Here we have only four forts which show evidence of occupation. And of course, merely because a fort was occupied does not mean that there was a military garrison inside of it in this late period. And there are a couple forts here in the south, and Udra is clearly occupied in Ayel here, but there are large gaps in the frontier, as you can see. In fact, there was, in fact, really no more of a Limes at all. Primary defense was now in the hands of these Arab phylarchs in this sector. And throughout Syria as well, I believe, up to the Euphrates. This policy worked for about 50 years, as long as a strong Ghassanid phylarchy was maintained. But the emperors who succeeded Justinian first weakened and then broke up Ghassanid power because they felt they could not trust the Ghassanids, but without any corresponding revitalization of the old defense in depth. Then, in the early 7th century, the Roman Empire and Persia fought a long and grueling war that lasted over a quarter of a century of nonstop warfare, and this left both sides thoroughly exhausted. At this precise moment, at the end of the war, in the 630s, the armies of Islam marched out of what is today Saudi Arabia. They completely overthrew and conquered the Sassanid Empire, and from the Roman Empire, or now the Byzantine Empire, they took the entire Levant, all of North Africa. Would the Muslim tribes have been stopped if Diocletian's defense in depth was still intact? Could the once powerful Ghassanid alliance have perhaps stemmed their advance? We'll never know this, of course, but clearly the successors of Justinian, and perhaps Justinian himself, paved the way with their disastrous frontier policy. This outline, then, I hope, has provided a view of Rome's policy along the frontier. My trek along the frontier has sharpened this view and underlined my appreciation for this enormous achievement of Roman arms, engineering, diplomacy, and civilization. Thank you. I'd be glad to entertain any questions if there are any. Rami.
Were the client states acting basically as their own self-contained armies patrolling their own regions, or did they also provide troops that were incorporated into some of the Roman garrisons?
They were ordinarily incorporated into Roman armies for field campaigns, but they did not normally serve in garrison duty outside of their own client state. An example, during the first Jewish revolt between 66 to 73 AD, armies of the Nabataeans, or troops of the Nabataeans, served in the Roman army, which helped to put down this uprising. But they would have never used Nabataean troops to do regular garrison duty in Palestine, or in a regular Roman province such as Syria. The only exception to that would be Palmyra, where Palmyrene dromedaries, the Palmyrene camel corps, was used to actually patrol parts of the Roman frontier. That's an exceptional case, I believe. Other questions? Okay, I guess that's all. Thank you for coming tonight. Appreciate it.